What the If is brought to you by listeners like you, thanks to our Patreon members, patreon.com/whattheif. Go there now and find out how you can become a member and get all kinds of cool rewards. And thank you for supporting our mission for science education and science fun. Welcome to What the If. Ifinity Edition. Playing with words. That's a tease. Coming up, our if of the week, our thought experiment of the week is coming up in just a moment. But first, let me introduce Professor Matthew Stanley of New York University. How are you, sir? I had the great pleasure to see you in 3D.
Oh, yeah. Well, technically 4D, I guess, if you're an Einsteinian. 4D! But yeah, because time did pass while we were there.
That's true.
But yeah, we got to hang out in person and enjoy some kebabs together, wear unusual glasses.
Absolutely. We were at the Rochester Museum of Science outside on the lawn where they had a wonderful eclipse festival. And we enjoyed delicious kebabs and kettle corn, I think
that's your appetizer. That was important. Mm-hmm.
Kettle corn was important. They had a band. They had, I don't know, looked like 1,000 people. It was fabulous, super fun. Totally cloudy, so it made for that kind of eclipse, mm-hmm. a different kind of eclipse, but still quite amazing. You can see some of our exploits on Facebook and Instagram. If you want to go to our page, What the If Show, I believe, on Instagram. And What the If on Facebook. And if you haven't gone to those pages in a while, go check them out. Mm-hmm.
They're exciting places.
There should be more going on there. I should put more up. But yeah, go check it out. See, tell us what you think. Also with us, someone with an even more incredible eclipse experience, almost doctor, Gavi Panicia of Rockefeller University. How was your eclipse?
It was spectacular. But it also, you know, was involved in a 40-hour road trip where me and the driver got maybe about 4 hours of sleep max. So it was definitely one of those things like, yeah, we went on a pilgrimage to see the eclipse, but it was well worth it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you had totally clear skies, is that right?
Yeah, so we drove up to a mountain in Vermont, and it was one of these things where it was like, one tall like mountain peak and then just like complete flatness around us. So no clouds. When the eclipse came in, we could literally see the shadow approaching us and getting closer. And then, you know, until it actually hit totality, perfectly clear too. So we could see like a solar flare on the sun. You know, it was really cool. And I now totally understand why people lost their minds when they were in the path of totality, because I knew what was happening and I still lost my mind.
Yeah, that's really cool. And to have seen the solar flare with your own eyes,
that's very cool.
Like, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, like I wasn't 100% sure what it was at the time, because my friend described it as it almost looked like a giant laser pointer because it was just that kind of like intense, bright, focused red. Yeah. Where it was just like somebody had like a giant laser and they were shining like, you know, a little laser pointer at the eclipse. And then later when I saw people who had, you know, much, much better closer up, you know, photographs of it, there was that, you know, solar flare. And I, you know, read something about, you know, that this is a thing that you could see them in eclipses, which completely blew my mind.
Yeah.
Because that's not anything I expected I'd ever be able to see with my naked eye.
That's super cool. I'd put that above the barbecue kebabs,
I suppose.
Just slightly.
Close tie. Close tie.
The funny thing was, oh, by the way, but Matt, we saw the shadow of the sun or even like the edge of it moving across the clouds.
Yeah, that's right. That's kind of an interesting feature of being clouded.
That's
in.
So cool.
Because you could see the shadow traveling across the clouds above us.
It was like Independence Day.
Yeah, a little bit. That's right. And it still went from, you know, daylight to total darkness, and then back to daylight again. So we got a sufficiently eerie experience. Very few laser pointers, though.
Yeah, it was wild. Mm. After the show, Suzanne and I went in to the planetarium for the planetarium show, which was pretty fun. And they said the person who led the lecture there for that said that they apologized for the clouds. They said they tried to arrange it otherwise, but that's all they could do. But they said because of the clouds, we actually got a darker eclipse than you might have otherwise.
Yeah. Yours looked pitch black from the post you guys made. For mine, it was dim, but it was like a strange sort of, like, it felt like sunset.
Yeah.
But it was just that very unusual, like, eclipse dim. Mm-hmm. But it was not, you guys were in, like, total darkness.
Yeah, yeah. But then in the planetarium, they showed us, they basically reenacted an eclipse on the planetarium ceiling. And it was pretty great. So we got a pseudo. So thank you to the Rochester Museum of Science for a lot of fun.
Yeah, great.
And, Matt, it was great to see you. Next time, Gabby, next eclipse, we'll have to get the entire IF team together. But I think, we were told if we assemble all in one place that it's a little risky.
Yes, that's right. Too many superpowers.
Yeah, that's, it's like,
yeah.
That, or I was going to say, we have to maintain, what is it, chain of command. We can't have all three of us in the same room or else something happens because then the podcast would just be over.
That's right. Checking in with the mailbag real quick. One of our longest time listeners, the super duper with the uber duper uberist, Bill from Winchester, Virginia. This music feels appropriate for Bill. Bill may be the only one for whom this music is appropriate. So we thank the What the If players for bringing that along to us. It won't stop. There we go. Thank you, players. Bill writes in, just before the eclipse, actually, Bill wrote in and he says, I'm sorry I've been absent. Sorry I've been out of contact for so long. I've been traveling and at times in remote places. Mm. Look forward to hearing about that, if you're allowed to share, Bill. He says, I have a backlog of about 3 months of What the If episodes to hear, enjoy, and study. Mm. So again, that is a dedication, Bill, that we salute you for that and we thank you. Bill says, while I was away, I continued to work on my rebuttal of the Drake equation that I called the pork equation. So we had a previous episode about that. Stay tuned perhaps for a future episode. I see something about the pork equation coming our way. Bill continues, I promise to begin listening to my backlog once I have sent in my federal and state tax returns.
No, he's got a hustle.
And I have read all my emails and texts and gone through all the United Postal Service junk mail. So it could be a while. We understand. He sent a picture of he took using two solar telescopes, mm-hmm. he said, left over from his astronomy phase back in the 1970s and 80s. And one of the pictures was very interesting. Again, we're an audio program, so I get to explain it. But basically, he took it with his iPhone, I think. One of them he took with the telescope, and it's an incredibly gigantic and sharp picture of the shadow of the moon over the sun. But then he sent another one in of the image of the eclipse from his iPhone, and it has like all kinds of weird colors in it.
Yeah, it was very strange.
Particularly a blue flare. And he says the blue crescent, I think, is a flare, peculiarly taking on the shape and size of the crescent sun during the eclipse. Several possibilities for this blue color. My guess would be either the color of the iPhone lens coating or the peculiar processor in the iPhone. Other possibilities, ghosting or light fall. And then he ends up by saying, my last optics class was in 1969 or 1970. I'm a bit out of date. And keep on ifing, says Bill. That is our slogan. Matt, you wrote to Bill and saying that you thought possibly there was some internal reflection.
That would be the technical term for the flare that he referred to. Like when we think of lens flares in an image, like in a J.J. Abrams movie, that's light bouncing around the inside of the camera usually. So we call that an internal reflection. So I suspect that's what's happening here because blue is a very strange color to get for this kind of image. So there's definitely something mysterious going on there. Could be alien communication too. I don't want to roll that.
I think it probably is. Of course. Mm-hmm. Actually, Bill, you should maybe get that. Get thee to a spectrometer. Mm-hmm. Pronto. So thank you, Bill, from Winchester for sending that in. And thank you for your years of service to What the If and your dedication. Right. That's absolutely amazing. We appreciate it. For our IF this week, our thought experiment, Our ifs come from many places. Sometimes we rip them from the headlines. Sometimes they just come from real life, like the eclipse. We did an eclipse-based thought experiment last week. Sometimes they come from you listeners. And if you have an idea, like Bill is working on one there about the pork equation, a rebuttal to the Drake equation, look it up. If you have an idea, send it to us. Go to whattheif.com and just click contact and shoot us your idea. We'd love to hear it and run with it. We have an interesting contribution this week from a non-human, I don't know if I can officially call it an intelligence, but I don't want to insult it. So a non-human intelligence, a website, an artificial intelligence website called Perplexity, which, by the way, is kind of a fun search, kind of a new version of Google using AI. It actually does a pretty good job at searching. Perplexity.ai. And I asked Perplexity for some ideas for ifs. And Perplexity came up with this one, which I thought was quite interesting. And it's interesting, actually, coming from an AI or from a search engine, in a way. This is what Perplexity asks. Perplexity suggests. It says, you could discuss the philosophical and practical aspects of a library with an endless number of books. You could speculate on the search for meaning in an infinite expanse of knowledge, the logistics of navigating such a library, and the impact on human understanding if every conceivable thought were already written. And I just realized why Perplexity suggested this, because I think you might need a search engine to help you.
Oh, it's trying to make work for itself.
Yeah, it's a make work project. Way to go. See, already we're being outsmarted by the damn things. So before we do this, Gabby, what is a thought experiment? What have unfortunate people who survived the eclipse, what have they stumbled into here?
Yeah, so what we do here is that, like Phil said, we do thought experiments where we take, you know, one idea, one concept, one rule about the way that the universe operates or the way that things are, and we speculate on what our world would be like if that single thing were changed.
Yeah.
And in the course of running with whatever absolutely zany idea this is, hopefully some real science falls out. Hopefully.
Indeed.
If we're doing our jobs right.
Indeed, indeed. And may fall on your foot. Therefore, we have safety protocols. Matt, can you tell us a bit about that? Can you be like the stewardesses who lead us through the safety check?
Let's see here. I guess in this case, if you can find the largest whole number that's near you and lock it down, that would probably be good. And you also might not want to stand too close to a bookshelf. Get thee to safety.
Get thee to safety. Shout out to the movie. Oh, God, was that movie? The Christopher Nolan movie about space. Interstellar. Bookshelves feature heavily.
Oh, that's right.
Heavily.
Yeah, that is bookshelf excitement. Yeah.
In fact, infinite bookshelves feature heavily in that movie. So good shout out. As we ask, what the if? There be a library that is infinite, 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 infinite. Could you borrow books forever? No, I don't know. What are the late fees at the infinite library? Perplexity.ai tells us to speculate on a library, an infinitely large library. Now, this comes from a work of literature. Isn't that right, Matt?
A fine work of literature, that's right.
Are you familiar with that work of literature? It's Borges, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's probably been a little while since I actually read it, but it occupies an important cultural and intellectual space. Is it called The Library of Babel, Gabby?
Yes, I believe
so. Yes, it is. Right? Yeah.
And this is often the case with Borges stories. I guess it's a little like our show, right? It takes a crazy idea and kind of runs with it. And this particular one is, as Perplexity suggests, the idea that there is a library in which every possible book has already been written. Presumably we have been granted access. We got our library cards and they're letting us in. Now we need to kind of figure out what to do with that, right?
Right. So let's imagine, I love the idea of this as a physical space, right? Mm-hmm. So would there... could there be, there could be an entrance, right? It doesn't, or I don't know. I mean, if it's infinitely large, is there a place you can walk in, or is it
just? I don't see why not. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. It can start at a place, right, and go on from there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So mathematicians can be cranky and call it a semi-infinite space if you want. but a semi-infinite space can still hold an infinite number of books. So we're good to go for that.
Yeah. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. That sounds like something a real estate agent could use. You know,
semi-infinite. Good book. Schools, nice neighborhood, semi-infinite space. Mm-hmm.
And so you walk in, and let's say there's a librarian there. Right. What do you, Gabby, what do you first, what's your first query for the librarian? Or maybe you don't have to talk to the librarian if you don't want. You walk in, what do you, what's the first thing you want to do in the infinite library of Babel?
Yeah. I mean, you know, normally when I walk into a library, I just sort of immediately go for the science fiction section.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I guess, if that impulse still holds true, I have to attempt to find it.
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So either the Library of Babel has a good organization system. There's, I don't know, some adherence to the Dewey Decimal System or what have you, where I can just say, all right, now I'm going to go down this infinite hallway and at some point I'm going to hit science fiction. Or now I got to just figure it out and just start pulling books until I hit some, I don't know, H.G. Wells.
Yeah. Usually I head towards what looks like the kids section because the science fiction section seems to wind up near the kids section often.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. So Dewey Decimal, well, actually, we should probably talk about this a little bit.
Yeah.
Is what we're dealing with here today is just an extreme version of the problem that librarians have always had, which is how to organize their collections in a way that makes it easy for people to get them, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different ways you could do that. Things like the Dewey Decimal System organize by subject or genre, right? So all of the astronomy books are put together and all the cell biology books.
Now, I'm just curious, do we think the Dewey Decimal System is used in libraries around the world, or might there be people, might we have listeners who don't know what that is?
Oh, that's entirely an American thing. I don't know how much other countries have taken it. I should say it's actually not a very good system. It just happens to be the system that most elementary schools have adopted, so it's the one that we all grow up with. That's what I was going to say. So if we organize by subject, and the idea there is that there are people like Gabby who are like, I don't really care about a specific book. I just want to go see all of the sci-fi, and then hopefully I can find something interesting from there. But you don't have to do it that way, right? You could organize it, the whole library, by author. So if you were just interested in Carl Sagan, then you could go right to the Sagan section, because his books would be filed in several different places by subject.
Right.
So it depends on how you want to organize. And this is probably the time when I need to tell the story of my encounter with the University of Cambridge cataloging system some years ago.
Yes.
Until sort of the early 20th century, every library had its own cataloging system. And then even every sub-library had its own cataloging system. So basically each librarian just made up their own system. Wow. And when a new librarian would come on, they would often make their own system too. So you get these weird partial things. So when I went to, this is Cambridge, England. When I went there to do my dissertation research many moons ago, they were just instituting an electronic cataloging system for the first time. But they were explicit that it was partial, and there's no guarantee that anything was actually going to be in there. Because the library's been there for 1,000 years, right? That's a lot of work to
That's
undo. So I was looking for a group of World War I peace pamphlets, like political propaganda. And I knew they were there because I had found a letter from the person, from a person saying, I deposited these at the university library. So I'm like, great. So I go and talk to the librarian and say, well, I'll start with the electronic catalog. So I go to the electronic catalog and I searched and it's not there. And it said, oh yeah, but only 1% of the library is in the electronic catalog. So you need to look in the books. And I'm like, okay. So, and what they meant by that were the physical gigantic books, maybe 2 feet by 3 feet, bound in red leather. And then the books are just handwritten in on these pages. And because they've accumulated over centuries, it's all like random stuff is pasted in. So I have to flip through all of these.
So is this a directory of sorts?
Yeah, it's right. Essentially a list of all the books in the library.
Oh my God, this is so Game of Thrones.
it totally is. That's right. But so I can't find it there. So I go back to the librarian and they say, oh, well, that's only like 10% of the library. So
what?
So then there's all of these sort of subject focused catalogs too. So she said, well, maybe it's in the political literature catalog. And I said, okay, that sounds totally plausible. So where is that? And I said, well, go up to the 4th floor and you'll find a little cabinet. And then that lists all of the books we have that count as political literature. So I go up, I look through there. It's not there. So I go back down. and she says, well, maybe it's in the pamphlet catalog. I said, okay, that sounds fine. So I said, where's that? I said, well, it's on the 7th floor in the back in the corner. So I go back there, and it takes me forever to find because it's mislabeled as Russian literature. But I finally it, and I look through there, and it's not there. So I go back down, and I say, so it's not there.
My image is that every time you go up an ever more rickety staircase.
Well, you're not wrong. So I go back down and I say, is it, is there another place it might be? And she says, well, I'm not really sure. And I pause her and I say, you know, is there a catalog of catalogs?
Oh,
and she says, snap. No.
Oh,
what?
I'm like, so you actually don't have a master list of all the different catalogs? She says, no, the librarians just know which ones we have. That's right, exactly. Yeah. That is their purpose for existence. Yeah. So if you happen to be there on the day that the person who knows your one thing is there, then you're in luck. But if not, if they're a day off, you would not know. Yeah. And I should say the climax of the story is she says, well, it's probably in the World War I collection. I said, okay, that sounds very good. Is there a catalog for that? And she says, no. I said, well, can I just go in and look? And she says, no, because it was sealed for 100 years after the end of the war. And I guess I've given away the dates of my journey to this library now. So the thing, so I actually never got the things I was looking for. I could go back now, I suppose, and find them. But it was an amazing experience of the contingency of catalogs.
What a cool, what's the name of that? I'd love to find a picture of that library.
It's the University of Cambridge Library. I think it's called it has some special name, but I can't remember what it is.
Yeah. Super cool.
Yeah,
super cool. But yes, unfound. So it strikes me that let's just begin with this. Can the infinite library have a catalog?
Well,
it would have to be infinite.
It would
itself,
be infinite
perhaps.
Too, right?
Yeah.
So it can't be written. But I think the subject areas might be our salvation here, because we can have an area that's just labeled science fiction. Right. And as long as we don't try to list every book in it, then we're okay.
Right. So Gabby, just what's a particular book or item we might be seeking? So we have a quest in this library. So we're looking for science fiction. Is there a particular book or a short story?
Well, not even science fiction or just short story. I think it would be funny to hunt for The Library of Babel, the short story.
Oh, that's
within The Library of Babel. It's got to be in there somewhere.
Very good. Very good. Very good. So, Matt, you ask the librarian there for the catalog of catalogs, and they say, no,
We and they say no.
No, that's right. So now...
Or they say yes, but there's an infinite number of them.
Well, and you know, actually, one move we could try to make, which is essentially what happened to me at Cambridge, is we can just grab the nearest catalog of catalogs and hope that what we're looking for is near the top.
Oh, okay. Right.
I think the odds of that are infinitely low, but you know, we could give it a go. Right. But I think what we probably want to do is guess what subject area this is going to be in. And actually, it's not really obvious. It's not really science fiction, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I figured it would be a kind of ambiguous one.
That's good.
Like speculative fiction?
That could be. But I don't know if I've been in many libraries that actually organize, bookstores organize it that way, but not usually libraries.
Well, we know, for instance, it'll be in the literature section. Like you were talking about the Dewey Decimal System, and the way the Dewey Decimal System works, if I remember correctly, is you have these very top header categories like nonfiction, fiction. And then within those, you then get subcategories, you know, so fiction you get.
Yeah, so maybe there's like an Argentine literature section or Spanish language literature.
Now, for there to be an infinite number of books, too, it strikes me that there would have to be infinite copies of at least some of the books. Because there's not an infinite number of, although Perplexity did ask us to say, it did ask us about the impact on human, what is the impact of human understanding if every conceivable thought were already written?
Right. So this is actually, I think, one of the I don't know, interesting and perhaps frightening implications here, too, is that if it's every book that can be written, then books that have not yet been written by human beings, but could be written by human beings, are in this library already. I should say, if I were in Gabby's shoes, I might try to find my dissertation. Right. It has.
See, well, what this raises to me, right? So there's already another layer to this personally as somebody who also writes fiction. If there's every conceivable iteration of a book that could be written, how many alternate drafts of a same story exist?
Oh, that's right.
Because I'm on draft 8 for a book. So does that mean that like 1 through 8 exist?
Right, and just for those who don't know, you've technically not finished your dissertation yet, and so what Matt is proposing is that there
I finished it. However, alternatively, there are 6 or 7 other copies of my dissertation that are there that are just other
very
versions
slightly different.
And
maybe you know. One of them, actually, maybe what you were saying, that you need to do a couple more experiments. There's some version of it in which those experiments have already been done. They may not be very good, but it's been done.
There was a more productive iteration of me in some small subuniverse, and so my thesis is much more robust in that one, and I will be stealing its data.
So finding that one will be tricky. And then when you do find it, I say the problem I would have here is that I would pull the version off the shelf and be like, oh, this is better than mine. Then I would think to myself, but you know, there has to be one that's even better than this one too. So then I would put that back on the shelf and look for the slightly better version that I know is out there somewhere. And I don't know, eventually I'm going to get hungry, but food is probably not allowed in the library.
Right, that's right. The food is not allowed in the library that has hallways that are infinitely long.
Yeah, it'll attract infinite mice.
Yes, that's right.
I'm imagining people or the people who work there having roller skates the way they are, you know, fictionally portrayed in the New York Public Library. Yeah.
Well, it is neat, at least to nod back to the story. The whole library has this unique hexagonal structure that it's not necessarily the same as having, like, you know, some gigantic room where everything to the left is nonfiction and everything to the infinite right is fiction. This is like these like honeycomb chambers of only certain amounts of books at a time. So each room kind of looks the same.
Yeah.
Whoa. Which is absolutely maddening. Actually.
So Perplexity really went all out and said, speculate and maybe this is something you can help us with, Matt, speculate on the search for meaning in an infinite expanse of knowledge.
All right.
What does that mean?
Well, so I guess there's a bunch of layers here. The first one, the first layer is probably just the infinite monkey problem, which I think amazingly we have not mentioned yet in this episode.
It came up briefly,
a lot before the show,
but it wasn't explained.
So there's this classic thought experiment, which I should say apparently comes from the guy I wrote my dissertation on, Arthur Eddington, the astronomer and famous science writer. So the thought experiment goes like this. If you take an infinite number of monkeys and put them in front of an infinite number of typewriters, and the idea being that there's no pattern, they're just whacking on the keyboards randomly, that eventually you will get the collected works of Shakespeare. Right. So this idea is put forward as a way of illustrating that even extremely unlikely things will happen eventually once you start messing around with numbers like infinity. The price of your collected works of Shakespeare, though, is an uncountably vast pile of works that are almost the collected works of Shakespeare, right? Uh-huh. So it's exactly, you know, the copy of Hamlet just has the word pork inserted in Act 3, Scene 2 for no particular reason. And that ruins it, right?
Yeah.
And that's so that's inconvenient. But on the other hand, you got your collected works of Shakespeare. You just have to wait a very long time and get a large number of monkeys. Right.
So if you see a book, for instance, you might very well have a copy of the collected works of Shakespeare that, say, has a typo in it, let's say. Pretty rare, but suppose it could happen. You could actually imagine that that's not just some typo. That's just one of the books
that is just one of the monkey produced books. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep. There is some publisher out there that is saving money by paying monkeys instead of
that's probably
writers,
true.
Right? So in terms of the search for meaning, there's a literal one here, is that you have to sort through huge piles of crap to get to the thing you're looking for. And one of the philosophical questions raised here is, does the correct works of Shakespeare actually have more meaning than the almost correct works too, right? I mean, there's the only reason we value one of them is because it looks like what we're expecting to find.
Well, I would say that to be or not to be has more meaning in it than to pork or not to pork.
To pork or not to pork? I mean...
But it depends.
It depends on your dietary restrictions.
It's just a different... Yeah. It's not more meaning. You're right. It's a different meaning. Yeah.
So that's a literal sense of this. And actually, Gabby showed us this website that lets you experience this yourself if you're so inclined. What's it called exactly?
Remember? I think it's literally called the Library of Babel.
Library of Babel.
Library of Babel. Let's see.
Yeah, Library of Babel.
.info.
Info. Exactly.
Info. That's
which is a very unusual extension.
I like how we went for info.
Yeah. All right. Can you explain how this works for us?
Yeah. So essentially, this was created by a computer programmer who realized that this was like a perfect way to sort of like use computing power. So because the original book, the Library of Babel, specifies this both organization system in the hexagonal library, but also like, you know, the books are all like 410 pages with a certain number of characters. So it sort of put these very easy frameworks on it that you can just, you know, if you're a computer programmer, it's very easy to permute through every possible arrangement of characters and write a script for that. So the idea is that like the website can generate and you can look through, I think it's something where like 10, the number I have up is like 10 to the 4,677 potential books, which is a truly astronomical amount of possible books. Mm-hmm. And there's an entire Reddit thread dedicated for people just sort of randomly going through them and finding ones that happen to make words or phrases or something like that. Because in an infinite number of books that have an infinite arrangement of like characters, you're going to get a lot of monkey key smashing.
Right. Basically, just for those who haven't looked at it, you know, basically what you look at, what you see on every page of every book in this on this website, every page, it looks like basically just a huge block of random letters.
Yeah.
Maybe 50.
And then sometimes might be able to like zoom in and see that like all of a sudden randomly the word from is at the center of the page.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then it just continues to be complete gibberish for however long. But the idea is that contained within these infinite volumes is eventually anything you're interested in finding. So that's where people like, you know, have found like, you know, all of a sudden in the middle of this thing, like a snatch of a sentence that is maybe vaguely coherent.
Oh yeah. And I hate to say this, Gabby, but could you search for like the opening paragraph to your dissertation?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I'm sure it's in there. Let me,
I'm super curious to see how many books have it.
Yeah, because this is the idea, right? That like the more specific you do, fewer books may have it. Like the more characters it essentially needs to match, but it might still be there. Let's see. Where's my? I'll use my actual first chapter opening versus the.
What are the first few words?
The abstract.
Is it "We the People" or how do you begin your dissertation?
So I have an introduction which begins with a rationale for the thesis project. Okay. So it starts with a very broad strokes sentence about infection and, you know, pathogens in general. So for anybody who's curious, it's for almost as long as there has been life, there have been pathogens.
Nice.
Oh, that's
basically my opening sentence.
That's the beginning of a great science fiction story, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm trying. I was like, let me not make this super, super boring for my committee. But there is a search function, and let's see.
You should start before the show. I same sentence.
Yeah. What was that?
I was
saying she should start her first novel or her next novel with that sentence too.
Yeah, exactly. Or you could just find your next novel in this library, infinite library, right? And then just
that's true.
So much easier.
So there is one book that came up. So the titles are also like all basically gibberish. My thesis defense that my thesis dissertation whatever appears in a book with the title QHQYC.MJ. Yeah, you know, it just keeps going.
The classic.
On page 100, page 114.
But then all of a sudden it turns into the actual text of your, the opening of your
page. And then it just immediately degenerates back to monkey slush.
I'm sure that some of these these programmers on Reddit have done things. You can write a program that just searches through the whole thing automatically, right? And finds.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody has at the very least.
Yeah, yeah. So Matt, as a philosopher, let's say, what does this? What's our kind of big takeaway? Well, you know, I'm looking back at Perplexity's question. Let me just make sure we covered all of Perplexity's thoughts. So, discuss the philosophical and practical aspects of a library with an endless number of books.
This really reads like a high school like English essay like prompt. Yeah.
So the logistics of navigating such a library, Perplexity wants to ask. How do you physically navigate a infinite space?
It's tough. You know, it's laid out in hexagons because hexagons tessellate, meaning you can have an infinite stretch of them.
Right.
So
as anyone who has played, let's say, Dungeons and Dragons and gone, you know, on a grid, the outdoor grids were always hexagonal, squares.
Yeah,
not squares.
Reasons.
Instead of squares, they're hexagonal.
You know, we had kind of hoped, or rather I had hoped, that it would be divvied up by subject already, so we could just go to the science fiction region and wander around and hopefully try to find what we have. And then we can have the unpublished dissertation region too. That kind of suggests that someone has already sorted it, though, which is probably not likely. I think we actually have to rely on randomness, and we can't. And that's really tricky, right? Assuming we have finite lifespans, there's no guarantee we're going to find what we're looking for anymore, even if we wrote it, right? Maybe we wrote that book, so we know it's in there.
Right.
like those pamphlets in the University of Cambridge. I know they're in there, but I have no mechanism for finding them.
Well, so again, this is why Perplexity gave us this idea, because you would need a search engine of suitable power to search this thing. And it could be that the science fiction department is as far as the other side of the Milky Way.
Or that's right. Far? That's right. I have no, and we're instead stuck in, you know, cookbooks or something.
Can you imagine being stuck in cookbooks
forever?
The size of the Milky Way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big cookbook, no question.
Exactly.
So I don't know. So one of our strategies might actually be, this is something that mathematicians do a lot, is we can just sort of declare victory, right? So if we want a book, let's say we're looking for the unified field theory that explains everything about the physics of the universe. We know by definition that it is in the library somewhere. We can't find it, but we know it's there. We're totally guaranteed that it's there. So we can just say we have the unified field theory. And that's it. Like, there's nothing more you can say. That's all you could want, is an assurance that it exists and that in principle you could go get it, even if you can't actually put it in your hand.
The refutation of that also exists.
That's right. But that just makes it better, right? Because then you've got guarantees that all of those things are true. And I don't know. Sometimes I feel like this is my experience of the internet, too, is that sometimes I don't bother looking something up because I know I could look it up anytime. So I'm like, well, I'll just look it up at some point in the future when I really need it. So all that information kind of exists in a potential state, but not in an actual state.
Schrodinger's knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
It is both there and not there until you go to look for it. And you're like, oh God, why the hell didn't I Google this earlier?
And in this library, and I guess maybe the perverse takeaway here is that the more information you have in this vast library, the less likely it is that you're going to be able to get it. And that's, I don't know, that's kind of metaphysically painful now that I ponder it, actually. Right?
Well, it also, it keeps coming back to the power of search engines of Google. Go ahead, Gabby.
No, I was going to say that, like, I mean, for one, I think it's confident that I can say this as a person who had to write a thesis. Hunting for information is hard, especially if you're not perfectly organized. It is difficult to tell what you have just purely by your own recollection. If, for example, the infinite librarians within the infinite library have done some sort of cataloging, it might, I guess, be possible to do a binary search sort of thing. I mean, it is still infinity. I don't know if that would work, but the idea behind, so the idea behind like a binary search is that if you're looking for a thing in, say you have like, I'm trying to figure out a good way to describe this, because I know how it works in principle, but like, say you have like 100 items, right? And they're all organized in like different shade. They're all different shades of red, right? And you're looking for a very specific shade. And they're, you know, distinctly organized across the spectrum. You can divide them in half and say, is the color that I'm looking for in the left half? Mm-hmm. No, that's all too light of a shade. So now that means it must be in the right half. Then you take the right half and you divide it in half again. And you say, okay, well, this left half is, you know, this right half is now too dark. So it's somewhere in this middle half. And so by doing that, you've ruled out, if it's 100 items, you rule out 50 in your first search. Then you're left with 25 and you rule out, you know, 12 or 13 rounding up.
Right.
So it's a way of rapidly narrowing down the amount of information that you're looking at by just sort of like bulk exclusion, rather than going through each individual book and cross-matching. If it's like alphabetical and, you know the author's last name, you could just be like, well, anything before this point is too early in the alphabet, so I need to go later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. I've had to do that many times in editing, in video editing. You might have, I might string together in the editing program, let's say 6 hours worth of footage. And I don't know, 6 hours is a lot of frames. So it's 24 frames per second times however many seconds are in 6 hours. And all of a sudden you're playing along, you're somewhere, anywhere in the sequence, and all of a sudden the computer stops. And the reason it does is because there's one corrupt frame.
Ah.
Exactly what a corrupt frame is, I'm not sure. Basically, it won't play. And the incredible thing is, it's somewhere in the sequence. It has nothing to do with where you are right now. How that works, I have no idea. Somehow the computer is trying to take the whole thing into memory, and it found one frame that was corrupt, and that screwed up the whole thing. So I eventually learned some years ago this trick of just cutting it in half, because then what happens is you can cut the sequence in half and hit play the first 3 hours, and it plays. So you're like, oh, the frame is not in that section. Then I go to the next and just keep, and very quickly, you can find the one frame out of, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I should say, if you take a computer programming class, you will spend a lot of time working on sorting algorithms, because it turns out this is a really, for small numbers, it's doable by hand. But for anything big, as most, say, the frames in a film would be, it becomes difficult very, very fast. So the difference between an efficient sorting algorithm and an inefficient sorting algorithm can be years, right? It might. Yeah. This is why, like, you know, those of us who use PCs, Windows Search is a famously bad system because it has an inefficient sorting algorithm. And for some reason, they've just never bothered updating it. And I'm a little bitter about this.
But. Yeah. I could be totally wrong about this, but maybe at just a very high level, perhaps, right? The AI works fundamentally by using one of the things it uses is gradient descent, this mathematical operation that basically just sort of looks at two numbers. You know, basically the AI is trying to narrow in on, is this a cat or a dog? And if it finds one number, and then you say, well, you're close, and then the next number is further away from the correct answer, then it knows, oh, no, I need to go back towards the middle. And that's how it narrows in extremely quickly on the right answer. So.
Yeah, so that kind of thing. So, yeah. And I should say, along those lines, there's lots of, let's see here. This becomes difficult enough that there are unsolvable problems, or at least theoretically unsolvable problems, that are various versions of this, like the traveling salesman problem, in which you have a town full of houses and you want to find the shortest route by which the traveling salesman can visit every single one of the houses. And it seems like that should be a very straightforward mathematical thing, but turns out to be fantastically difficult. Or the Hilbert Hotel, which I guess is a variation on this too, named after the mathematician David Hilbert. So Hilbert Hotel has an infinite number of rooms and an infinite number of guests and things like, can you switch the guests around and stuff like that? I guess suffice it to say that an enormous amount of human ingenuity has been spent thinking about how to sort very large numbers of things, and can you actually get what you want at the end of the day?
Yeah. I think, by the way, my last image of this infinite library is that it is full of researchers going down endless, infinite rabbit holes, you know, with glee, right? I mean, the only thing that would stop me, you know, when I was assigned to do research, which is the best job in the world, by the way, just go to the library and start finding stuff about some topic. The only thing that would eventually stop me was eventually I had looked at all the possible books or all the possible sections where anything of value might have been in. If that didn't end, I would just keep going because it's just so cool finding all kinds of cool stuff. Gabby, how does your search end? Do you find a copy of your dissertation that you like and then choose that one? And then I guess you have to go to the photocopier, which may or may not be working. Usually it's not.
Yeah. I mean, I'm expecting that there is absolutely no way in an infinite library that I managed to find my dissertation. But speaking as a gigantic nerd, I definitely think it would be cool to just, like, you know, take three friends and like go up a hallway and just see what we find. And I'm sure we probably wouldn't be the only people. Like, there would definitely be people, you know, going off into the infinite dark of the library. And maybe this is, I've definitely been reading too much horror, because I'm imagining mentally like a smash up of the Library of Babel and the House of Leaves. If you're familiar with the House of Leaves, it's like a house that just keeps spawning infinite corridors that go on forever. And now I'm imagining like people sort of getting endlessly lost in the library and going off, you know, in pursuit of knowledge and losing their mind in the deep, dark depths.
That's cool. And possibly running into exact copies of yourself.
Yeah, or exact copies of my dissertation, which is equally terrifying.
Yeah.
Nay, horrifying, actually.
Lastly, Matt, I just have to ask, what do you think the late fee structure is in the Infinite Library?
Well, so late fees are only going to get assessed if the librarian actually, because you drop it off in one of those big bins, right? And the librarian has to go through that bin, find your book, check it against the borrowing records, and then when they check it back in, then they level the fee. So fortunately, the late bin is also infinitely large. So odds are they will not get to my late book before the death of the universe.
Right.
So I'd say, screw it. Damn the late fees, and we'll go on and not worry about it.
And then also leaving you with that horrible situation when you're in the library, you are a researcher, you're looking for a book, and it says it's checked out, and you're pretty sure it was checked out a long time ago. You're pretty sure it may have been returned, and it may be sitting in the returned bin, just not checked in yet, and you can't.
Yeah.
Can't get to it.
Head.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been wonderful to reimagine. It's been a long time since I thought about the library as a functioning place. for those of you out there who, like us, remember libraries, maybe you are even fortunate enough to still have one that you use. That would be fantastic. I do love one of my favorite libraries is the library at the New York University, the Bobst Library. But there are fewer and fewer books on display there every year.
That is correct.
Yeah. As the number of tables for people using laptops grows. So thank you, perplexity.ai, for stimulating our minds with this question. Thank you, Gabby and Matt, for being so brave as to enter the library. And a shout out to Borges. First name, Luis, is it?
Jean Luis? Jorge Luis?
Jorge Luis. As we search the infinite library for the answers.
to find his name. And the weird thing is, of course, there are authors with all of those names, right?
And they're remixed versions of them. It's Jorge Luis.
Jorge Luis Borges. Gracias. And so, Matt, do you have anything you want to plug this week?
Oh, no, I think I'm done plugging for a little bit, actually, now that the eclipse is over. If you're my students who did not hand in their papers yesterday, please do so as soon as possible.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Did that really happen? Somebody?
Oh, yeah.
They maybe just lost in the infinite library.
Well, it happens. Yeah. I would accept that as an excuse. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gabby, do you have anything you want to plug?
Yeah, I guess. The Map of Lost Places is a horror anthology releasing, I believe, sometime around November. I have a science fiction horror short story in it called Codewalker that is actually partially based on, it's about digital archaeology and also is partially based on an episode that we did about spinal reconstruction. It was somebody learning to walk again because they had essentially functionally reconnected their spinal cord by using machinery. It was really cool. So if you are curious, that, like I said, that comes out sometime in November, I think, but I'm giving you all adequate lead up, I think.
Fantastic. Is there a link for pre-order?
I don't think there's a pre-order link yet. I only see the Kickstarter information.
Right.
But I know it's coming out. They've just started sending us, edits, and it's very exciting. I think it should have somewhere around 30 stories in the anthology, close to it. So it should be pretty beefy, but also pretty interesting because it seems like they've gotten a wide range of different subgenre type stories.
Yeah, that sounds
exciting.
Yeah. I can give a shout out to, a wonderful website that those of you who love libraries might enjoy. So as I've mentioned in the past, I'm making a documentary about the video game Myst, M-Y-S-T. And as part of that, I had done a Kickstarter a few years ago. And one of the rewards for the Kickstarter was if you gave at a certain level or above, if you donated to the film, you would be invited to the what did we call it here? The Story Vault. Mm. And the Vault of Stories, I just opened it in the background. The Vault of Stories, in which a gigantic chamber in which you would be offered a fresh, empty journal with blank pages, and you could enter your story, your memories of playing the video game Myst, thoughts you might have into this journal, and you could then put them on the file them into the system of the library, and there are gigantic shelves all around. It's a Myst like experience. You walk around, point and click adventure. You walk around and you can read all these different books that have, some of them have videos and pictures in them that people have written, and lots of beautiful text. You can go to Vault, V-A-U-L-T, dot the Myst documentary. Again, that's M-Y-S-T, vault.themystdocumentary.com, and you can check that out. So I invite you to do that. And thank you all, everyone, for imagining with us this week. And thank you, Bill, for your sending in your wonderful letters. And a shout out to Lars in Sweden. We know you're out there, and we appreciate your reaching out to us. And everyone else who's been listening so long. If you've not contacted us in a while, do so. We'd love to know what's happening in your neck of the woods, especially if you are inside a library of any kind. Gabby, would you help us with the closing ceremonies? What do we need to do now?
Yeah, we have to find some way to pack up this infinite universe, because we find ourselves moving forever down infinite hallways, hunting for a version of our thesis that's better than the one that we have. And it's getting dark, and we're getting tired, so we can't help but shout the name of the show. What the
Thank you all for listening. Shout out to librarians everywhere. We'll see you next week. Patreon supporters, don't forget to check out your bonus content only for Patreon listeners. Patreon.com/whattheif. Come with us and experience beyond the if. If you're a Patreon supporter, if you're not, find out more. Patreon.com/whattheif.